Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome. Today, we're doing a deep dive into Khalil Gibran's The Prophet. It's a book that's been a kind of cultural touchstone for about a century now, almost like a shortcut, you know, to finding really profound meaning in the everyday stuff of our lives.
Yeah, it really is. And this book is kind of perfect for this format, actually. Yeah. We're basically pulling out the core universal wisdom from its main character, Al-Mustafa. He's this prophet figure about to leave the city of Orphalese after, 12 years in exile?
12 years, yeah, a long time.
And he spends his last moments giving these 26 really powerful poetic talks, sermons almost, on the human condition right before he gets on his ship to go home.
And that whole frame, the prophet waiting for his ship, it gives the text this this incredible sense of urgency, doesn't it? A kind of farewell wisdom. What's truly remarkable, I think, is how a book written way back in 1923 still speaks so clearly to us now. It offers this unified, deeply spiritual view of life that, importantly, kind of sidesteps specific religious dogma. Mm. It gives guidance on the really big questions. You know, how to love, how to approach work, how to make sense of suffering.
So our mission here, then, is really to get a handle on Gibran's overall worldview. He basically took centuries of philosophy and, synthesized it, argued that real wisdom doesn't just come from studying doctrines.
Right.
But from deeply consciously thinking about these fundamental human experiences, mm-hmm. and all the while recognizing this essential unity behind everything. It's a blend of lived experience and ultimate insight.
So it sounds less like a religious text and more like a practical guide for the spirit. It's constantly pushing you, the reader, to ask, how can I find some peace, some purpose right now, you know, in the middle of my messy daily life?
Absolutely. And to really appreciate that vision, I think it helps to understand the person behind it. Khalil Gibran. Born 1883 in Lebanon, he was a Lebanese-American writer, poet, and, interestingly, a visual artist, too.
Right. He painted as well.
Yeah. He moved to the U.S. as a kid, which gave him this really unique bicultural viewpoint that, you know, clearly shaped everything he created.
That bicultural perspective is, I think, absolutely key. He wasn't an academic, not a priest or anything. His authority, if you like, came from his own lived experience. He drew from the Bible, the Quran, Hindu texts, Buddhist ideas.
It's a real melting pot.
But also mixed in that fierce individualism you find in Western thinkers like, say, Nietzsche or the visionary poetry of someone like William Blake.
And what's fascinating is how he weaves all that together. He takes Eastern ideas like essential unity and maybe spiritual detachment and merges them with Western concepts like radical self-expression, the power of the individual. You can definitely feel Nietzsche's influence there sometimes. Yeah. He essentially built this philosophical bridge, didn't he? Translating complex, sometimes abstract, Eastern spiritual ideas into this beautiful, accessible Western literary style.
And that ability, that skill in distilling really profound concepts into poetry that just hits you. That's why the book has such universal appeal, I think. It's a poet tackling life's biggest questions, but with the heart of a genuine seeker.
So let's get into the structure of the book itself. Like we said, it's a farewell talk. Mustafa is leaving Orphalese, and the people basically ask him for his wisdom on all the main parts of human life. That generates the 26 prose poetry chapters, mm-hmm. and the order he puts them in, it doesn't feel random either.
Oh, interesting. Is there a logic to it then? Why those specific 26 lessons and in that sequence?
It feels very intentional, yeah. The book kicks off with the really intimate stuff, love, marriage, children. Then it sort of expands outwards, looking at social interactions, work, giving, laws. And finally, it tackles the big existential themes, joy and sorrow, and ultimately death.
I see.
The whole journey seems designed to broaden your perspective.
Yeah.
Moving you from thinking just about your individual self towards understanding this this unified whole.
So the goal isn't just to give advice, like a self-help book might. It's trying to shift the reader's fundamental relationship with life itself, showing us how to see all the complexity, but also find the underlying harmony connecting it all.
Precisely. That's a great way to put it. So let's dive into some of those core teachings, maybe starting with the intimate relationships that really define so much of our lives.
Okay, yeah. Got to start with love. Mm-hmm. Al-Mustafa describes true love as this. Well, transformative force, almost violent sometimes. It demands complete surrender. Mm. And he warns that real love, it can't possess or be possessed. It's going to lift you up. He uses the image of a harvest, but it might also crucify you. You have to kind of accept both sides of it, the pain and the pleasure.
And if That wasn't challenging enough. He immediately follows it up with something even more radical, maybe, in the section on children. This has one of the most quoted lines, certainly in modern parenting circles. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself.
Wow. Yeah, that line, even hearing it now, it's such a profound challenge to that sense of parental ownership, isn't it? If my child is like a living arrow that belongs to the future and I'm just the bow, well, how do I actually do that practically without feeling, I don't know, disconnected? It almost sounds like he's telling parents to just let go completely.
Well, I think Gibran is pushing for stewardship over ownership. The love is absolutely still central, but that controlling impulse, that need to shape them into your image, that has to be let go of.
Okay.
The bow gives the arrow strength. Sure, it helps guide its initial direction, but the arrow ultimately has to fly off to a place the bow can never really reach. It's about recognizing their own inherent independent destiny.
That theme of independent identity definitely carries through into his discussion on marriage as well. He really insists that marriage is a spiritual partnership that actually needs the individuals to keep their own separate spaces.
Ah, yes, the famous analogy.
Exactly. The pillars of the temple stand apart so they can support the same roof.
That's where it gets tricky, though, isn't it? It sounds lovely, but how practical is that idea day to day? When does that necessary space tip over into just, you know, distance? Or even loneliness? Is Gibran maybe prescribing a kind of separation, not intimacy?
That's a really fair question. I think Gibran's point is that if the pillars lean too much on each other, they actually become weak, unstable. For him, real intimacy isn't about two half people merging into one whole. It's about two strong, independent individuals choosing to share a purpose, giving mutual support without giving up their essential freedom.
So it's almost a warning against that kind of codependency that can sometimes disguise itself as commitment. Okay, shifting gears a bit, let's move into the social sphere, specifically work. Gibran totally reframes work. It's not just a burden. It's an act of, well, spiritual worship almost, self-expression, he says. Work is love made visible.
I have to admit, when I hear work is love made visible, part of me feels a little guilty about, you know, hating my overflowing email inbox or those really tedious tasks you just have to do every day. How does that incredibly lofty ideal survive contact with the, let's face it, modern reality of the 9-to-5 grind for many people?
Gibran sort of anticipates that, I think, by focusing not so much on the task itself, but on the intention behind it.
Right.
He argues that when you pour your love, your dedication into any honest labor, even if it's cleaning floors or doing accounts, you're actually contributing to the cosmic order. You're achieving a kind of spiritual fulfillment. The work itself becomes this opportunity to serve and express your highest self. It's about transforming the mundane into something sacred, really, if you approach it with that consciousness.
That's powerful when you think of it that way. Okay, let's look at the big existential stuff. In the parts on joy and sorrow, he doesn't treat them like opposites you choose between, but as like inseparable parts of growing.
Right. He says the deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can actually contain. It's the very same well that your laughter comes from that was often filled with your tears.
It's easy, maybe, for a prophet figure to romanticize pain. But for someone listening who's dealing with real loss, real grief, doesn't that sometimes risk sounding a bit like spiritual bypassing? You know, just telling people to buck up and appreciate the lesson. How does Gurnan keep that idea grounded and useful, not just poetic?
He grounds it, I think, by stressing conscious engagement, not just passive acceptance. He isn't saying pain is good. He's saying it's inevitable. And if we resist it, if we shut down, we actually prevent the expansion of our own capacity for joy later on.
Ah.
Sorrow is like the carding tool, breaks that shell of our understanding, as he puts it. It forces us to grow our awareness. It's a necessary catalyst, really, for deeper self-reflection.
And that kind of holistic view, it stretches into society, too, especially in his discussion on crime and punishment. This is where he gets incredibly challenging for many, I think.
Oh, definitely. He fundamentally sees crime less as pure individual evil and more as a symptom of social failure, of disconnection. If someone in the community stumbles, he asks, well, who among us isn't also partly responsible?
Right.
He pushes for a profoundly restorative approach to justice. The focus should be on healing, understanding, reconnection. Not just retribution.
Which leads directly into his skepticism about external authority, like in the chapter on laws.
Absolutely. He suggests human laws are just these imperfect attempts to write down natural moral principles. Real freedom doesn't come from just memorizing rules or, fearing punishment from outside. It comes from connecting deeply with your own inner moral compass. He's constantly pointing the individual back towards their own inner authority for true guidance.
Okay, so listening to all this, it feels like there are some core themes running underneath all 26 of these discourses, tying them together.
Yes, definitely. I think the first, and maybe the most fundamental, is this idea of the unity of existence and balance. Gibran is constantly trying to break down the dualities we tend to create, reason versus passion, good versus evil. For him, wisdom isn't about picking one side, but about integrating these seeming contradictions.
So the takeaway for everyday life there is, maybe don't see conflicts as just forces to choose between, but as complementary parts of a bigger picture that somehow need to be reconciled, first within yourself. That sounds, well, exhausting, but also maybe essential.
It does, yeah. And this unity idea leads straight into the second big theme, the spiritual dimension of daily life. Gibran's real genius, I think, is in elevating the ordinary. Eating, walking, working, even buying and selling, these are all chances for spiritual growth if you approach them with awareness, with gratitude.
So seeing mundane tasks as a kind of sacred practice.
Exactly.
I really like that. And the third key theme seems to circle back to suffering. The transformative power of suffering. Pain isn't just an obstacle to get past, it's actually a teacher. It's what breaks the shell of our understanding.
And that conscious engagement with life's challenges, that's what marks spiritual maturity, perhaps, as distinct from just spiritual adolescence. It's what builds our capacity for deeper understanding and ultimately for greater joy, too.
It's really no wonder these concepts have stuck around, especially because they're packaged in some of the most memorable poetic lines ever written. Let's maybe revisit a few of those quotes that really capture this philosophy.
Sure. The one we already mentioned, work is love made visible. That's such a powerful reframing, turning our daily labor, potentially, into self-expression and a contribution to something bigger.
And that really radical quote about pain. Your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. It completely shifts the perspective on suffering, framing it as this necessary catalyst for growth and awareness. It gives it purpose, in a way.
And for relationships, that guidance is just timeless. Let there be spaces in your togetherness, for the pillars of the temple stand apart. That's the core idea, isn't it? Insisting on individual identity and freedom within connection.
These quotes really showcase Gibran's power, taking these ancient, sometimes complex, spiritual truths and making them feel instantly resonant and accessible. But how do we actually apply this stuff, beyond just nodding along and thinking, oh, that sounds nice?
Okay, let's try. Starting with parenting. Applying that children discourse might mean parents consciously try to shift from being controllers to being guides. Focus on modeling the values you care about, providing a stable, loving base, but then intentionally practice letting go of needing to control the outcome, respecting their unique journey.
Right. Easier said than done sometimes. And for personal development, we could apply that balance theme, reason and passion. So when making a big decision, maybe don't just rely on the pros and cons list. Try to consciously integrate the logical analysis with your intuitive feeling, your gut instinct.
Yes.
And maybe use those moments of difficulty, of pain, not for just avoidance, but for immediate self-reflection. Okay, what is this feeling trying to teach me? What shell is trying to break right now?
And in our professional lives, that work is love made visible.
Yeah.
Idea. Maybe it inspires us to actively look for purpose, even in the roles we currently have.
Yeah.
Focusing on excellence, on dedication, on how our work serves others, even in small ways, regardless of whether we get external praise or recognition for it.
So if you focus on the love you put into it, the 9-to-5 could become more of a spiritual practice, less just about the paycheck.
Potentially, yes. That's the invitation.
You know, what really stands out most for me about Gibran, thinking about it now, is just the sheer democratization of wisdom, maybe. He elevates the ordinary, the everyday, to the level of the spiritual. He makes these profound insights feel accessible to absolutely everyone, regardless of their background or beliefs. You don't need a special retreat. Your kitchen table could be your altar, so to speak.
Yeah, I agree. And the lasting insight for me is that invitation to spiritual maturity, which seems to require us to embrace life's full complexity. You have to try and integrate the things that seem like total opposites, joy and sorrow, freedom and responsibility, into a single coherent lived reality. The real work isn't about trying to avoid the hard parts. It's about leaning into them consciously and letting them transform you.
That really is the ultimate challenge, isn't it? And Amustafa gets on his ship at the end, but he promises the people of Orphalese that after a little while, his longing shall gather dust and foam for another body. It hints at this continuity of existence, the eternal cycle of life. It leaves you with this final provocative thought. Maybe the search for self-knowledge, for meaning, it never truly ends. It just keeps changing form across time.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.